clearance for scientists funded by fellowships from the AEC, Oppenheimer fired off an angry letter to the AEC. The Institute, he wrote, would no longer accept such fellowships on the grounds that the required security investigations violated its traditions. Only a month later did Oppenheimer inform the trustees of his action. According to the minutes of the meeting, some trustees expressed the fear that the director's action might involve the Institute in a political controversy, specifically with the FBI. Oppenheimer was told that in the future, he should consult with the board prior to making such decisions. In the spring of 1948, Oppenheimer gave an interview to a reporter from the New York Times in which he talked freely about his vision for the Institute. He said he expected to invite many more scholars, or even non-academics with experience in business or politics, for short-term visits of a semester or a year. Oppenheimer plans to have fewer life members, the Times reported. And then the reporter gave this breezy description of Oppenheimer's job. Suppose you had funds at your disposal based on a $21 million endowment. Suppose you could use this fund to invite as your salaried house guests the world's greatest scholars, scientists, and creative artists, your favorite poet, the author of the book that interested you so much, the European physicist with whom you would like to mull over some speculations about the nature of the universe. That's precisely the setup that Oppenheimer enjoys. He can indulge every interest and curiosity. Needless to say, some of the Institute's life members winced at these words. Others took offense at the notion that their director could run the Institute according to his intellectual whims. Oppenheimer committed another indiscretion in 1948 when he quipped to Time magazine that, "While the Institute was a place where men could sit and think, one could only be sure of the sitting." He went on to say that the Institute had something of the glow of a medieval monastery. And then he inadvertently wounded the sensibilities of the permanent faculty by suggesting that the best thing about the Institute was that it served as an intellectual hotel. Time described the Institute as a place for transient thinkers to rest, recover, and refresh themselves before continuing on their way. Subsequently, the faculty told Oppenheimer that it was their very strong opinion that such publicity was undesirable. Oppenheimer's larger plans for the Institute often met with resistance, particularly from the mathematicians, who had initially thought he would favor them with appointments and an ever larger share of the Institute's budget. The arguments could become extraordinarily petty. "The Institute is an interesting paradise," observed his perceptive secretary, Verna Hobson. "But in an ideal society, when you remove all the everyday frictions, the frictions that are created to take their place are so much more cruel." The fights were mostly about appointments. On one occasion, Oppenheimer was presiding over a meeting when Oswald Veblen marched in and insisted on listening to the discussion. Oppenheimer told him he had to leave, and when the mathematician refused, he adjourned the meeting to another room. "It was just like little boys fighting," recalled Hobson. Veblen frequently instigated trouble for Oppenheimer. As a trustee, he had always been something of a power broker inside the Institute. Many of the mathematicians, in fact, had expected Veblen to be named director. Instead, as one Institute professor put it, this upstart Oppenheimer was brought in. Von Neumann had actively opposed Oppenheimer's selection as director. "Oppenheimer's brilliance is incontestable," he had written to Strauss, "but he had serious misgivings as to the wisdom of making him director." Von Neumann and many other mathematicians had favored replacing the directorship by a faculty committee with a rotating 1 or 2 year chairmanship. Instead, they got precisely what they did not want, a strong-willed director with a broad, complicated agenda. Oppie exhibited the same patience and energy at the Institute that had characterized his leadership of Los Alamos. But according to Dyson, his relations with the mathematicians were disastrous. The Institute's mathematics school had always been first rate, and Oppenheimer tried hard never to interfere with their business. Indeed, during his first year as director, he presided over a 60% increase in the number of members coming to the School of Mathematics. But instead of reciprocating, the mathematicians invariably opposed many of his appointments in the non-mathematical fields. Frustrated and angry, Oppenheimer once called Dean Montgomery, a 38-year-old mathematician, "the most arrogant, bull-headed son of a bitch I ever met." Emotions ran deep, and led to irrational outbursts. Oppenheimer was out to humiliate mathematicians, said André Weil, 1906 to 1998, the great French mathematician who spent decades at the Institute. Oppenheimer was a wholly frustrated personality, and his amusement was to make people quarrel with each other. I've seen him do it. He loved to have people at the Institute quarrel with each other. He was frustrated essentially because he wanted to be Niels Bohr or Albert Einstein, and he knew he wasn't. Weil was typical of the bloated egos Oppenheimer encountered at the Institute. These were not the young men he had easily led in Los Alamos by the force of his personality. Weil was arrogant, acerbic, and demanding. He took an almost roguish delight in intimidating others, and he was furious that he could not intimidate Oppenheimer. Academic politics can be notoriously petty, but Oppenheimer was confronted by several paradoxes peculiar to the Institute. By the nature of their discipline, mathematicians invariably do their best intuitive work in their 20s or early 30s, whereas historians and other social scientists often need years of studious preparation before they became capable of genuinely creative work. Thus, the Institute could easily identify and recruit brilliant youthful mathematicians, but rarely appointed a historian who was not already well-seasoned. And while the young mathematicians could read and form an opinion about a historian's work, no historian could do the same for a prospective candidate in the School of Mathematics. And herein lay the most vexing paradox. Because the mathematicians were in the nature of things quickly beyond their prime, and because they had no teaching duties, in middle age many of them tended to devote themselves to other affairs. If not distracted, the mathematicians inevitably turned every appointment into a controversy. Conversely, the non-mathematicians, being older and facing the prime productive years of their careers, had little interest or time for such academic intrigues. But, unhappily for the mathematicians, in Oppenheimer they found themselves confronted by a director who, though a physicist, was determined to balance the Institute's science culture with the humanities and social sciences. To their dismay, he recruited psychologists, literary critics, and even poets. On occasion, Oppenheimer, worn down by these territorial intrigues, vented his frustrations on those close to him. When he caught Freeman Dyson indiscreetly gossiping about an impending appointment of another physicist, Dyson quickly found himself summoned to Oppie's office. "He really flattened me," Dyson recalled. "I saw him at his most fierce. It was bad. I really felt like a worm. He convinced me that I had really betrayed all the trust that he'd ever had in me. That's the way he was. He wanted to run things his own way. The Institute was his own little empire." At Princeton, the abrasive streak in Oppenheimer that was so rarely seen at Los Alamos would sometimes appear with a ferociousness that startled even his closest friends. To be sure, most of the time Robert charmed people with his wit and gracious manners, but sometimes he seemed unable to contain his fierce arrogance. Abraham Pice recalled several occasions when Oppenheimer's unnecessarily biting comments caused young scholars to come into his office sobbing. Rare was the lecturer who could fend off Oppenheimer's interventions, but Res Jos did it memorably. Jos, a Swiss mathematical physicist, was giving a seminar one day when Oppenheimer interrupted to ask if he could explain a point in further detail. Jos looked up and said, "Yes," but then proceeded with his talk. Oppenheimer stopped him and said, "I meant, will you explain so-and-so?" This time, Jos said, "No." When Oppenheimer asked why, Jos replied, "Because you will not understand my explanation, and you will ask more questions and use up my whole hour." Robert sat quietly through the rest of Jos's lecture. Restless, brilliant, and emotionally detached, Oppenheimer always seemed an enigma to those who observed him up close.
Pice, who saw him almost daily at the Institute, thought him an extraordinarily private person, not given to showing his feelings.
Rarely, a window would open up to reveal the intensity of his emotions.
One evening, Pice went to Princeton's Garden Theater to view Jean Renoir's 1937 La Grande Illusion, a classic anti-war film about comradeship, class, and betrayal among World War I soldiers. After the lights went up, Pice spied Robert and Kitty sitting in the back row, and he could see that Robert had been weeping.